Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome to Volume 13 in the Brecan Making Connections Information Sessions. Making Connections is a program of events for women living with advanced cancer. This session was recorded on the 10th of May 2012 at the Brecan Resource Centre in the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. Dr. Richard De Boer is a consultant medical oncologist at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and Epworth Freemasons Hospital. Richard has a clinical interest in the relationship between advanced secondary breast cancer and bones. In this session, he will talk about new treatments for bone metastases in advanced breast cancer, current thinking, and management strategies. We hope you enjoy this session.
Thanks, Jane, for coming. New familiar faces. Just come from a breast clinic and a few faces who are normally in that clinic, I notice. But thanks. I think hopefully the next hour or so will be of interest. It's about bone disease. I see that I think African drumming looks more interesting next month. but I'm not sure if I'm any good at that. So I'm going to talk about bones. I've given a few talks here before, trying to cover various issues in bones, but a lot of the issues were for early breast cancer, and I think there was a request to talk a little bit more about bones in advanced breast cancer, which often, you know, you get to at the end and you have a quick chat. So this is really designed to talk about people whose breast cancer has gone into their bones. So I make no apology for that. It's sometimes a bit confronting to talk about that, but that's what we're going to focus on. It was there before. And it's an area of some new work's been done. There's a new drug that's come out in this particular area, which I have some experience with, so we'll talk a bit about that. But we'll talk a bit about the history of it and the importance of this problem, what we can do about it, where we're going with this treatment. And look, if people have questions, interrupt. It's always a bit tricky if you've got a very personal question about, you know, why didn't this happen or why didn't that happen. Of course, I can't really answer that. But some people do ask that, and I appreciate that. But the question should probably be designed to try and answer a question that you think might be interesting to a few people. You know, I've got this particular side effect, is that common? Or I'm having my treatment every X months, is that how people do it? Or why am I doing this? You know, maybe a question that revolves around the drugs or the treatment rather than, you know, I had this pain and no one x-rayed me, why not? I don't know, that's always a hard question to answer. So yeah, advanced breast cancer and bones. So bone health is an area that I'm very interested in, but it covers a lot of different areas, and most of my talks are more revolving around that. So this talk is much more about the bone metastases question, which has been around a lot longer. And some things I want to discuss is about these drugs called the bisphosphonates. So Zometa is the classic one, which I'm sure people in this room either have had or still have. Some issues around how they work and why they work. I'm sure some of you have questions about how often they should be having them and for how long they should be having them. And then the second sort of half or sort of third will be about the new agent that's come through called denosumab or Xgeva is the other name for it, which some of you may be on or may not be on. But that's, I think, an area to know about if you've got bone secondaries, because most likely you'll come across that drug at some point. I'm not going to talk about these things, because these are things that I talk about when someone is newly diagnosed. We're very interested in trying to prevent people from getting breast cancer in their bones in the first place. That's a different talk. I can talk about that later if people want, but the complaint last time was I spent all my time on that and not enough time on that. So cancer in bones is a very common problem. It's not just breast cancer that's the issue. And I see a few men in the room. So prostate cancer is down there, and it's a very common problem in prostate cancer as well. So immediately you think, hormones and bones. There's a connection between hormone-driven cancers and the bone. We don't quite understand it. as you can see, breast and prostate, a very common problem. It does happen in my lung cancer patients. It does happen in a disease called multiple myeloma, which is a very bone-related disease. But also some of the other cancers also go into bones. But breast and prostate and myeloma are the really big ones. Now, in breast cancer per se, in at least half the patients, it's the first place where their cancer comes back, if it comes back. Bone is the most critical place, more common than lung or liver or brain. And that is because most breast cancers are hormone-related. And for some reason, hormone-related breast cancer, if it comes back, it likes to come back into the bone. And in time, if you get all the patients who have had their cancer come back, at least 70%, if not more, will have a bone secondary. So if it's not the first place, it often comes later. So if a patient of mine comes in and is complaining of pain in their liver region and I unfortunately find out they've got a liver secondary, it's not uncommon if I go looking further, I might find a little bone spot as well. I didn't know it was there, it's hiding away. So the bone is a very common place, and it can do various things. There's a fractured hip, there's a fractured spine, there's a spot in a vertebra, which you may or may not feel anything. That's the more common thing we find. Luckily, we don't see this sort of stuff too often anymore because of our better treatments and people are being a bit more aware of reporting symptoms. Now, there's lots of issues with bone secondaries. So these are the things that can happen to the patient. They can have a fracture, they could have a pressure on the spinal cord, they could get very high calcium levels, they may very commonly need some radiation. I'm sure many of you have had some radiation to bone, and occasionally they need surgery to bone. So they're all the things that can happen because of the bone secondary. Some of them are there's the symptoms as well. So what does that lead to in a turn? So of course, if you can't get around very well, you lose your ability to do your things you want to do. Quality of life is definitely reduced. Pain is a big issue, of course. Nobody wants to have bone pain. And you know, I suppose for the bean counters out there, people with bone secondaries require resources, end up in hospital, etc. So lots of reasons why you don't want to have bone secondaries, all sorts of things. And you know, there's evidence in the past, in particular, if people get bone secondaries, particularly if you don't control them and treat them very well, then that affects not only how they live, but for how long they live. So you want to keep it under control. Because particularly things like spinal cord compression, where you can't walk anymore, like a paraplegic sort of thing, not a good thing to have for anyone, let alone someone who's got cancer on board. It becomes a very complicated, difficult situation. So we want to avoid those things as much as possible. And thankfully, with our treatments, we do avoid many of those things. Maybe not the pain all the time, maybe not the occasional fracture, but certainly if you talk to, I sort of just overlap with that era, but if you talk to some of the guys in their sort of late 50s and early 60s who were looking after breast cancer patients in the 70s, 80s and early 90s, really before our drugs started to come through for bone thing, the ward was full of people with these problems. There's always someone in there with high calcium levels. There were always people with fractured spines and fractured hips. You rarely see that these days. Not impossible, but it's not that common, thank goodness. And that's because of treatment. So there's two things. One is if you've got a spot in your bone, that's one thing. If it causes you a problem, that's the second thing. And that's got a term which will come up a bit in this talk, which is, it's called skeletal-related event, which is SRE. So in the language of the bone world, you talk about SREs, because, okay, you may have a little spot in your bone, but I've got ladies with spots in the bones that haven't done anything for 10 years. Or you can have a spot in your bone which causes a fracture. Or you can have a spot in your bone that needs radiation. That's an event. Something's happened to you, you've needed some action, or you've had a problem. So that's called the skeletal-related event. And you can see breast cancer, these are the patients who have a spot in their bone, there's a high rate of events. So women who get breast cancer in their bones quite commonly get a problem, whether it's pain, whether it's the need for radiation, whether it's need for some surgery, etc. So it's an important issue. I mean, if 100% of women got a blind spot but none of them had any problems from it, that's different, but they do have problems. You do in other diseases, but not quite so commonly. So not sure exactly why that is, but certainly makes it an important issue to discover and manage. The second thing about these skeletal-related events is that they're often multiple. So what that means is if you've, in the days, this is also before, this, a lot of this stuff came out before they had good treatments. If you had one event, you quite commonly then had a second one, or even a third one. So someone might come in with pain and then some radiation, and then 6 months later they might come in again with another pain, need more radiation, or suddenly they have a little fracture somewhere and then they get a problem somewhere else. So they can sometimes multiply. And you can, sometimes they've tracked that out, they have no problems and they have two or three problems in their bones all in a row quite quickly. And again, that emphasises getting good treatment on board to try and stop that. It's not just stopping the first one, we don't want you to have any problems. If you have one, we want to stop the second or third problem from happening. So who are the people who get the problems? I mean, rather than the people who get the cancer in their bones, who are the people who get the problems from the cancer? People with very active cancer in their bone. Obviously, if the cancer in the bone is really moving quickly and dividing and causing problems in the bone, they can get fractures and pain. People who've previously had a problem are a bit higher risk of getting a second problem. I just talked a little bit about that. Interestingly, people who have cancer only in their bones and nowhere else. So breast cancer patients sometimes can have it in various places. But quite a few of my patients were just in their bones. I mean, not just, it's in their bones, not in anywhere else. And for some reason, they seem to have a slightly higher risk. Usually they've got more spots in their bones. And somebody's also got liver and lung disease, for example. Obviously, the number of spots, if you have lots of them, I suppose it's more likely one of them could cause you a problem. And people who've got a lot of pain. I mean, that's always the thing we tell patients. We're getting a lot of pain in a spot where we know there is a cancer. That there's a sign that something needs to be done or needs to be thought of being done. This is a bit complicated, but it's an important concept because it relates to the treatments we use and how they work. So there's a destructive or vicious cycle. So I don't even look at it, it's probably better to think it's simple. When I was or junior, I always thought that if a cancer got into the bone, the way it caused a problem was the cancer itself would be eating away at the bone. That's actually not true. It doesn't do that at all. The cancer sits in the bone. They're the tumour cells. The cancer produces little messengers, that go to the bone and tell the normal cells in the bone to start breaking the bone down. It turns on a switch. So the normal things in your bone, I'll explain that in a minute, are told by the cancer to work harder and to start breaking the bone down. As it breaks the bone down, that in turn releases little messengers in the back direction that float back out to where the cancer is and encourages the cancer to grow. So that's how they sort of like a feeding mechanism. So the cancer tells the bone, break yourself down, and the little breakdown things that come out of the bone tell the cancer to grow, and back and forth and back and forth. So the treatments we use, this is important to understand, because the treatments we use for bone are designed to try and stop that talking between the two, to try and put some sort of barrier between the bone talking to the cancer or the cancer talking to the bone. So it's not the cancer itself that's sort of causing the damage to the bone. It's the normal parts of the bone being switched on. So our bones are living, they're constantly changing. Certainly when you're growing as a kid and as a teenager, but also later in life. You break a bone, it heals itself. So to do that, it's got two little people in there. It's got a little part that makes bone and a little part that eats away the bone. And they work together. I always think of it as a bit like a bricklayer and a two tradesmen, one's breaking down a bit of a wall and the other guy's getting the bricks and remaking it, if you're going to reuse the bricks. So you've got them working together. You need both of them. So in a normal bone, if I jump up on a spot for the next 6 months, my body will react to that and strengthen up my hip area because I'm putting all this pressure on it. It'll break a bit down, it'll lay a new bit, it'll work together and I'll get a stronger hip from it. The problem in cancer is that the cancer cells makes the destructo, the guy who breaks the bone down, work much harder. And the bricklayer can't keep up with that. So you're sort of eating away the bone, and the little guy trying to make new bone can't keep up with it anymore. So the bones start to disintegrate a bit. That's how you get the fractures, that's how you get the high calcium, that's how you get the pain. So what we want to do, what we try and do, is to turn that off somehow. And the most of the treatments we've got effect here is trying to stop that little destructive man from eating away the bone. That's what our treatments are trying to do. Which is good, and it's very effective, but it does have some side effects, of course. But this is this vicious cycle. That's what we're trying to do. Now, the ultimate thing, of course, is if you don't have these, the cancer cells, then the rest doesn't matter. And so most of you who are on some bone treatment will be on something else as well for the cancer itself. You know, whether it's a hormone tablet, anti-hormone tablet, or some chemo, or some Herceptin, or something. Because what we, obviously the ultimate is to try and get rid of the cancer, then you don't have the problem anymore. But it's sometimes very hard to get rid of every cancer cell in the bone, and so we often keep the bone treatment going as a protective device. So if someone comes in with a bone secondary that's causing them problems, obviously we've got painkillers. The key thing is good anti-cancer treatment. Surgery sometimes required if there's an imminent fracture or, you know, something along those lines, particularly hips, very important. Of course, you walk on them. And radiotherapy. So radiotherapy is very commonly used. Sometimes, depending a bit on the hospital you go to, some people get a single shot of radiation, some people get 5 days or 10 days or 15 days. Depends a bit where and exactly what they're treating. Now, I'm not going to talk about all those things because, I mean, painkillers, obviously, pretty important. You know, the type of chemotherapy or Herceptin or hormonal therapy you're on is unique to your cancer. And that's obviously mapped out by your specialist. Surgery hopefully is not required very often, or maybe at the beginning. Radiation is used from time to time if you've got an area that's causing you pain, the ribs. You know, I've got a lady yesterday who rang, her rib is flaring up a bit. She's got a few rib spots, so getting it straight to the radiation guy to have a treatment to that little area to try and get it back under control. But I'm mainly going to talk about it's a fancy name. But it's basically this concept of what are the drugs that can turn off those little bone eaters. They're called osteoclasts. And they're in our bone, they are normal things, but they get turned on by cancer and we want to turn them off. And the main thing I'll talk about is the bisphosphonates, which many of you will be on. The classic, as I said, is Zometa or zoledronic acid. Some of you may be on the tablet variety, particularly if Bondrinet. And then I'm going to talk about the newer drug that's come onto into the scene, which is this drug called denosumab or XG. But these sort of things down the bottom, and I'll show you a slide right at the end. There's a huge amount of work being done in this area because we think it's all our area, but it's not. The bone doctors have been going for 200 years. The osteoporosis doctors, I mean by that, the hormone guys, they have a very different picture of the world. They're interested in osteoporosis and how to prevent that. You know, I'm interested in cancer and how to prevent that, but we sort of have some overlap between the two of us. So if you bump into someone who's got osteoporosis, they may be on the same drug as you, but just not quite as common as often. You know, so Meta and Fosamax and stuff, they're all in that same family, and osteoporosis doctors have been using them for years. We just use them slightly differently. So the bisphosphonates, they've been around for a long time. And that, so they work, I see it, they work like a wet blanket. They just sort of sit on the bone and turn those little osteoclasts, those little Pac-Men, they turn them down. And so therefore slow down the bone, stop it eating itself, stop it encouraging the cancer from growing. They're used a lot in osteoporosis. They've been used in cancer for quite a long time to prevent calcium or to treat very high calcium. And we've used them a long time now in bone secondaries. And there's a whole lot of new things going on, and that's the other talk. Trying to protect bones from osteoporosis, because many of our treatments cause osteoporosis. Trying to prevent cancer from even getting into bone in the first place, that's really what we would love to do. And hopefully, you know, improving the outcomes of people. And there's a couple of trials going on, one that's almost finished now in Melbourne, for new patients with breast cancer, early breast cancer, trying to stop seeing if you can stop cancers from developing in the bone in the first place. So bisphosphonates, just put up your hand if you're on Zometa or the Midronate or something like that, so most people. Anyone on Xgeva or denosumab? Yeah, two ladies, yeah. It's interesting because I was in a think tank recently and clearly there's some people who use them more and more, new patients, and there are some people out there who don't use it at all yet, which is sort of, we'll get onto that. So certainly just bisphosphonates, which the majority of people are on or have been on, some of you I'm sure may have been on it for years. I've got patients who've been, one lady from 2002, who's just cruising along, keeps saying maybe you want to stop, but she doesn't want to. So there's intravenous or oral. So straight away you've got the decision, would you rather have it through a drip or would you rather take it by a tablet form? And there are pros and cons. People in the pharmaceutical industry always think that everybody wants a tablet, but tablets have their own problems. If it's got to be a daily tablet, if you know you've got to hang yourself upside down and not eat for 3 hours with each tablet, you know, and if it gives you indigestion or diarrhea versus, you know, once a month you have a needle and, you know, have a treatment in 15 minutes and then you can forget about it. So people often don't realise that. Some people prefer that. They're happy to take it every day and do various things around it. But there's clearly a preference. And certainly if you go to states where more people live in the country, if you go to Queensland, you know, West Australia, you know, where there's big rural populations far away from hospitals, the oral ones are very popular. Because, of course, to drive for 8 hours once a month versus taking it at home, big difference. Victoria's more centralised. It's not as big an issue usually for people to come once a month. But there's various ways of doing it. The most classic one is the Zometa. 4 milligrams, usually given once every 3 or 4 weeks, but I suspect there might be a couple here who have it less frequently. You need to check the kidney function with it. You need to make sure people are taking vitamin D and at least some calcium, preferably in the diet.
Yeah. How much?
Of which?
Calcium, vitamin D.
Well, I think first of all, it's probably worth getting your vitamin D checked if it hasn't been checked. And if it's okay, 1,000 units a day, which is one Osteovit or Ostalin. The trap I see mostly people fall in is they're told to take Caltrate Plus. It doesn't have enough vitamin D in it. There's plenty of calcium in it, but it doesn't have enough vitamin D. You need the vitamin D with a bit of calcium, not calcium with a bit of vitamin D.
So what's your number, what's your acceptable number? Because I have had my vitamin D tested.
Look, it varies a bit on the lab you go to, what's normal and stuff, but I'd certainly want it over 50. I mean, the normals on Melbourne Path is 75. I've yet to see a woman with a first test, I can't remember, maybe 2 out of 100 who had a vitamin D in the normal range. Everyone has it low to start with, 10, 15, 30, 40. It's no disgrace, it's so common. Most of us live indoors. But to push it up a bit, absolutely. I mean, Ian Gawler, you know, is pushing it up to 200, 250s. Not sure if there's any evidence for that. To me, always excess too much or too little can never be a good thing. You know, we're sort of designed pretty well. But pushing it up around, you know, 70, 80, 90 is not a problem. Too high vitamin D will lead to kidney stones.
What's too high then?
Well, I would, you know, out of the normal range, so 200, 250. Is there any evidence it's beneficial? No. Is there any evidence it could do harm? Sure. So, but it depends what, I mean, there's different philosophies, isn't there? There's people who want to push selenium or push zinc or push vitamin E or push, so there's always a group who'll say, oh yeah, take huge doses of this, it's the best thing. My role mainly is to say, don't let it be too low. If you don't have vitamin D, you can't get vitamin D outside of the sun, really, and the tablet, you're not going to absorb your calcium. It enables you to absorb calcium. So you can drink 10 litres of milk a day, but if your vitamin D is zero, you're not going to get it in. So it's pointless. So to me, get the vitamin D right and the calcium will probably follow. Whether you need calcium supplements as well, depends a bit on your diet.
Sorry, what did you mention as opposed to Caltrate Plus? You mentioned
it's Ostalin or Osteovit. Yes, that's the high. They're across the counter. You go to any chemist, they'll have. And just ask which is the cheapest. So it's even on my shelf at home. Because men have low vitamin D too. Just ask which is the cheapest one. Just look at it, and there's the. It's not in milligrams. It's IU, which stands for international units. And you just want to make sure what you're taking in a day. really the minimum is 1,000 units. Now there are some formulations of Austerlin Plus, they've got a bit of calcium in them. My understanding, most of those have got 500 units in, so you'd probably take two of those. The others are all 1,000. In overseas, you can get tablets with 5,000 units and stuff, which would be useful. And a couple of the hormone doctors have told me if they've got someone who's really low, they just get them to go to a compounding chemist who can make up tablets with 20,000 or 50,000. And so they say just take one of those a week rather than three or four every day. But certainly, and for the new drug coming up, there's just been a problem that's popped up in the last week, of course, which just emphasises the critical importance of making sure your vitamin D levels are okay and that you're having enough calcium. Because these drugs, the bone drugs, are fantastic at helping your bones, but what they do, your bones is where all your calcium lives. It's like a big warehouse full of calcium. And once in a while, your body will want to take some of that calcium out to help brain function, nerve function. And if you're not taking any calcium in, or you've got no vitamin D so you can't get it in, then the body's going to be reaching into that warehouse more and more. The problem is, if you're on a bone drug, the warehouse sort of is not locked up, but it's hard to get it out. And so if it's hard to get out and you're not getting enough in, then your calcium drops. And that can, if it really drops, even be fatal. Because your brain function, nerve function, and the electrical systems in your heart that needs a bit of calcium. You need some calcium, that's why you've got it. So too high makes you really sick. Too low, really low, can make you really sick too. So that's really just been emphasised in the last week, that make sure your vitamin D is being replaced and check it once in a while, not every time you have a blood test, but you know, early on, probably every 3 months or so, just to see is it climbing up. And once it gets into the sort of normalish range, and make sure you've got a bit of calcium in your diet. Now, sorry, I'll get to the bone guys tell me they prefer their patients to eat it rather than to supplement it. Calcium's probably a little bit safer if you take it in diet. There was one study that suggested people took lots of calcium supplements might get a bit more calcium laid down in their blood vessels. You know, controversial. Then you've got some guys saying, no, it's terrible. All the old ladies in the nursing homes now no longer get their calcium supplements and they need them because they're not getting any dairy food. So there's this debate that goes on about how best to get your calcium. But if you eat yogurt, cheese and milk a bit, as long as you've got good vitamin D, you're probably going to be pretty good at absorbing the calcium. But if you don't eat those things, then you need to take some calcium as well.
Are there any early signs of calcemia?
Technique, which is twitching muscles. Not just a little, you know, flick of ear, but quite widespread twitching. Not cramps, that's a different thing. But I had one lady who got a dose of Zometa, and 2 days later she was admitted to Frankston, you know, where she lived down the peninsula, with, you know, tightening up muscles and, you know, that it wasn't quite that extreme, it was happening and she was quite sure, and so luckily she went in and she had a calcium that was sort of half of what it should have been.
From your lecture last year, I quite managed to get my...
You remembered it?
I wrote it down. My vitamin D levels are fine. Can I say the higher I can get my vitamin D levels, still, you know, up around the 90, 100, the better I feel. But I don't like dairy, and I've tried and tried, and this month, you know, my calcium levels come in slightly low. Next month, it'll be just at normal level. What particular calcium? I'm happy with the vitamin D, so I need to supplement calcium. Is there a particular brand or type? Is it calcium carbonate or calcium citrate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether there's one that's better than the other in terms of calcium supplements. I suppose in the end, one that suits you best probably makes most sense. Because calcium tablets can sometimes give people a bit of diarrhea or a bit of, you know, digestive issues. I mean, I don't do it myself, but I've spoken to a few patients because they don't really like them. So I suppose you need a bit of trial and error with the calcium. Now, there are the vitamin D tablets that come with calcium in them, you know, the Austerlin Pluses and stuff. Maybe that might be an option. I don't know. But... yeah, look, it's tricky. I mean, it's hard because it's hard to be exactly sure how much dairy. I mean, coffees and stuff, I presume I've got enough calcium coming into my diet, but I don't measure it. But some people have very, very little at all.
Yeah, well, it's done. I mean, the blood tests, I have IV Bondurant, and it's done before that.
Yes.
That's so I get it every month, and I just sort of think, oh, do I need to add another yogurt in when I actually have to force it down because I don't like it?
The other thing is, you were saying about your blood tests, I was just thinking about this morning because I saw some bloods on a patient of mine who's getting so messy, and I thought, they always check the kidney function, that's one of the side effects, but probably, you know, what's gone on the last few weeks, you know, having the calcium checked, you know, maybe if you're going to check your kidney function, it's no harder for them to press a button on the machine to get the calcium. Maybe they should be checking calcium each time as well, which is something we do maybe at the start, and then we go, oh yeah, that'll be fine, but maybe we should do it more often as well.
Mine's done monthly, so I'm not.
I'm wondering if dairy is the only diet because other cultures don't have a lot.
I'm sure there must be other things.
Would seafood, for example, would be mine?
I'm not sure. Dr. Google would tell me. So yeah, no, I'm sure there are other. I mean, like, you know, vegetarians can cope without meat and stuff, so they get, you know, you can probably get protein, you can get things in various ways. So I'm not sure if nuts or something.
Almonds. Do you like almonds?
Is that a little bowl of almonds they had out there?
Yes.
I might need to do that, and 2 days before I'd have to have the calcium levels checked or he won't do it, and it was just borderline last month. So is it up the calcium? Because if it's down, no way, they won't give it to you.
Yeah, and that might be a little bit extreme, but I suppose it depends where it is. I mean, if it was around the normal range, probably okay. We're talking calcium levels are very low.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think if you're not a big dairy eater, you hate calcium tablets, the time I suppose to take it would be to say, well, 2 or 3 days before my next treatment, and for 2 or 3 days after it, I'll throw in some extra calcium tablets to try and boost it up over that period. Because it seems to be around the time of the treatment that's the problem.
Just moving away from calcium for a second, you have checked renal function up there, and I think I missed something there. What is the issue with renal function?
So the bisphosphonates, particularly the more powerful ones, do interfere with kidney function a little, or can. Now, in breast cancer, and cause a bit of renal in kidney impairment, and they're excreted through the kidneys, so you've got to keep an eye on that. Now, in breast cancer, well, that's not a huge issue, because very few patients with breast cancer either get drugs that affect the kidneys or have kidney problems. It's a massive issue in the world of multiple myeloma, where they often present with kidney failure, or in prostate cancer, where they can get problems with blocking of the kidneys because of the prostate cancer itself. So a very important issue for those diseases. Less so for breast cancer. And in fact, you know, I've always, from a kidney point of view, patients on Zometa, the people who taught me said, look, unless you've got a patient who you know has got a kidney issue, you can take the bloods on the day of the treatment and use that for the next treatment. What I don't like is patients having to have blood tests 2 days before every time they come in for a bone treatment, because you had enough blood tests anyway, and needles and stuff. So it's a pain in the bum to go, you know, two needles every month. So my feeling, and certainly in the kidney, now the calcium thing might be a little bit different, but certainly the kidney function, if you come in for your Zometa and your kidney function is fine, you know, you do the blood test, have your Zometa, go home, kidney function comes to you later today, it's fine. That I'm happy to run on that for the next Zometa, you know, and just, so I'm always one behind, so to speak. But it's not something that happens like that, it builds up. So if over a couple of blood tests I notice the kidney function just starting to drift off a little bit, well, okay, I'll start to think about the dosing of it. And I suppose with the calcium, I'm a little bit the same. I think if you've got good calcium levels and we've checked it a few times, I'm happy just to check it every time. Whether I'm going to hold every drug until I see it, you know, a bit like the old blood test for chemo, I think it's a slightly different question. I think if someone's on vitamin D and they're taking their calcium, and the last three calcium levels are fine. Don't know. I suppose I would probably, I'm always looking for the soft option, I suppose, for my patient. I'd probably just say, have your blood test on the day. You know, it's been fine the last 6 times or 8 times, and we'll just run with that. But, you know, some people are much more pedantic and say, no, you've got to have it 2 days before, it's got to be checked before I give it. Don't know if we have to, in a healthy, otherwise healthy person who's, you know, looking after themselves, don't know if we have to, absolutely have to do that. I mean, 2 patients in the world have died this year, possibly due to
low calcium, possibly related to their bone treatment. One of them had lots of other things, was very sick for other reasons as well, so they're not quite sure. But those are the things that you, people have got to pick up and just remind everyone, because there's probably people out there who are not on any calcium or any vitamin D, who haven't never had it checked, who are just merrily going along, and they're probably going to be fine, but it just emphasises, you know, it's just going to make sure that you've got the in place. And to be fair, the people who make these drugs have always said you should have calcium and vitamin D supplementation, and all the trials have it. But I think the idea now is you've got to be a little bit more rigorous about telling people to do it. So what are we trying to do with the bisphosphonates? I mean, it sounds all very complicated. What we're trying to do is to just dampen down that turnover of bone. We just want to stop the bone sort of leaching itself out, so to speak. That's the main thing, because that's where all the problems come from. And by doing that, we want to prevent, you know, problems in the bones, the pains, the fractures, etc. Yeah, it's a good pain reliever, that's important, and quality of life, obviously. We want to keep that as good as possible.
So yeah. Dementia does help with the pain, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's not the answer for every problem, but it's been shown in, and I'll show you some of the results. It's been quite clear people who are on the bisphosphonates, their pain control is better than those who are not. But it's not guaranteed. I mean, it's not every person is going to fall into that. So this is a little cartoon of what the bisphosphonates do. So here's your... I remember the Pac-Man game? This is, I think of osteoclasts as little Pac-Men. Munch, munch, munch. That's their job. They're supposed to do that. And there's all these sort of little talks and little messages and stuff. But the bisphosphonate goes and coats the bone. And then the little Pac-Man who's eating into the bone eats up some of the meta, for example. And it basically sort of poisons the little Pac-Man. Turns him off. Now, that's a good thing because it stops him eating the bone. But you can think of some situations probably poisoning something that's normally there must have some negatives as well, and it does. But I suppose we're dealing with people who've got, you know, cancer in their bones, where if you fracture your bone or you have a spinal cord fracture, it's a disaster. So to me, to oncologists, some of the side effects of these drugs, while we wish they weren't there, are completely outweighed by patients being up and around and, you know, feeling good and not having pain and not fracturing their hips and all that sort of stuff like it was 30 years ago. So of course there's some negatives and of course we don't like them. I'll talk about some other ones in a minute, but to us the balance is completely in favour of them because it prevents all those bone problems that people otherwise used to get. So I know statistics are really boring. It's probably the only one of few statistical slides, but this, it's not that long ago, 1996, so 16 years ago, this was the study that said, hey, we should give ladies with breast cancer and bone secondaries, it was permidronate, that's one of the older ones. And this was chemo and permidronate versus just chemotherapy alone. Not a lot of patients, you wouldn't get away with it these days, they want more. But the patients who got the bone protecting drug, the time to their first bone problem, instead of being only 7 months if they got just the chemo, it was over a year, so almost twice as long before they got a problem. The number of patients who got any problem whatsoever, 56 down to 43. The patients who got pain relief, well, the chemo gives pain relief, but it was better with adding in the bisphosphonate. They got a better response in their bones to their treatments. The number of patients who needed radiotherapy dropped from 33 down to 20. The patients who needed surgery dropped from 10% down to 4%. So we would see all those things as good things. Now, they're not perfect, but they were a real step forward. An important point is it didn't seem to affect how long people lived with their cancer. That's an important thing. These are drugs designed to make you live better with your cancer. Okay, it's the chemos and the hormones and the Herceptins and stuff that really, you know, tackle the living with the cancer, or the length of the stuff. But these drugs are about living better with the cancer, so that's an important point. But this was enough, and people say, wow, this is worth doing, and really now you hardly see a patient with a bone secondary that isn't on one of these drugs, or at least offered it. There's different potency, so that means how powerful they are. So there's a meta out there. That's the most powerful of the bisphosphonates. Bondronate, which someone comes oral and IV, is not far behind. Pamidronate, which is one of the original ones, is a little bit less potent. And that's alendronate is the phosphonates that people take as a osteoporosis. Now, potency just means if they stick a little bit in a rat, how powerful it is. You can overcome that by the dose. So people don't have to think, oh my God, I'm on the abandronate, that's not strong enough. You get 50 milligrams, I mean, you get a 6 milligram dose, so you get a bit more. So the dosing is different. This one here, the dose was 1,600 milligrams, you know, orally, and the oral one there is 50. So you get the huge dose difference to overcome that problem. But when people were developing these drugs, of course, they thought, well, this will be an interesting one to test because it's quite powerful. Will it actually be a bit better? And it proved that it was a little bit better, particularly to the one that we used to use. So that's why we, about 6-7 years ago, we shifted most of our patients from that one to that one. And in terms of tablets, this one's still available, but we tend to use that now if we're going to use a tablet because that's more potent than that. So they're the sort of two we tend to use. And in Europe, they mainly use that one. And in the States and Australia, we've mainly used that one. I won't jump over that slide. So just some of the facts about what, you know, what we've learned a bit about being on Zometa or any of the bisphosphonates. So this is the patients who've got a bone spot. How many days till they get a problem in their bones? And this is called placebo, so they're on a fake tablet. And then the yellow bars, that's for the clodronate, the abandronate, the pimidronate, and the zoledronic acid. And the green bar is how many days before they get a problem if they're on that real drug. So you can see the difference. So on average, a patient who got the chemo and their hormones or whatever, about a year later, they got a bone problem. While the people who got the Zometa, you know, it's out getting out towards, you know, 2 years before they got a bone problem. There's quite a big difference if the bone problem is going to be a fracture or need of radiation. So, and you can see the abandronate or the bondronate, very similar result. So this sort of information says, hey, good thing to add into our other treatments, helping to prevent people getting problems in their bones. Pain issues. This is about, it's a bit complicated. The bottom line here on this, I won't go through it, but one of the things when I first started out was we only used them if someone had a problem. So if you did a bone scan on someone just by accident and you found a couple of small bone spots and they had no symptoms, when I first started, the rules were, no, don't put them on the Zometa, wait till they get a problem. And the government still thinks a lot like that. It was cheaper to do that, isn't it? Because if they never have a problem, they never need the drug, so you save money. But the mounting evidence, and this is sort of a complicated way of showing it, was that if you've got a bone spot, even if it's got no symptoms, if you treat it, you delay the onset of the symptoms. Yeah, and you may prevent the symptom. So we sort of shifted with the bone treatments, because we think they're pretty user-friendly usually. To if you get a bone scan done by accident, almost, you know, or as part of, you know, your trial or whatever you're on, and you find a bone spot, even if it's not causing you any problems now, you probably think about putting on the bone treatment in a way to almost like prevent the bone problem. And when I was in Japan talking about these things, they pointed out that they do bone scans quite regularly on all their patients from the day, you know, once every year on their new patients. For that reason is that they want to find the bone spot as soon as it appears so they can put them on the bone treatment to try and prevent the bone spot from becoming a problem. Which is, yeah, it's a complicated area. Whether it's the right thing to do or not is interesting, but that's sort of the reason why they do bone scans on their patients quite regularly. If you have got cancer in your bones, pain, of course, is the thing nobody wants, and this was just a comparison of the change in the pain score. The lower the score, the better. So patients on the Zometa, their pain score dropped down and stayed sort of down, while the patients on the placebo, the fake thing, it didn't do too badly for a while, probably because they were on other treatments, but then the pain started to climb up. So I mean, it does wiggle around a little bit, but, you know, quite a big difference there. So again, people on the bone treatments will be getting less bone pain on average. Quality of life, they've tested physical, functional, emotional well-being, this was a comparison again of patients getting zoledronic acid versus not, and quality of life seemed to be improved by, presumably from a pain point of view. The other thing, and why some doctors are reluctant to change people from the intravenous to the subcutaneous, it's been shown quite a lot that if you go regularly to visit a treatment team and have a chance to chat, even if it's informally, that can be a help in your quality of life compared to someone who's doing it all at home. Because there's emotional well-being from seeing people you know, seeing nursing staff that you know, being able to just sort of chat a bit, maybe point out a little problem and getting it dealt with. People who sort of try and do it all by themselves, sometimes, particularly pain, can get a bit out of control before they somehow stick their hand up. So although if you ask someone, would you rather an injection or a tablet, well, most people say, I'll have the tablet, thank you. Quite a lot of my patients say, look, once a month to come in for the injection, have a chance to sort of think about what I'm doing, chat to people, talk about my problems if I've got a new thing. Sometimes that might be a very useful thing, both from picking up an early problem and emotionally, then you have to do it all from home. And I feel a bit isolated coming in just once every 3 months for my routine check. So I think quality of life is a complicated thing. Primarily it's driven by pain. If you've got no pain, most people are much happier. But there are other issues with quality of life and how best to treat people. Now, the question is how often to have it, Zometa. Now, if you're on Zometa, tell me, just put up your hand if you get it every 3 to 4 weeks. Put up your hand if you get it less frequently, every 6 or 8 weeks. Yeah, so a lot of people are getting it a little less frequently. And that's sort of... that's a really interesting and complicated area. So, because you've got the drug company, of course, wants you to have it as frequently as possible. If you're in the public system, the chemotherapy unit would rather you come as less frequently as possible because they're too busy. And so it gets complicated what's the right thing to do. And in fact, funnily enough, there's not actually a lot of good information. So some of the early work suggested that this is weeks, week 1, 2, 3, 4, that if you look at the bone turning over, you give a dose of the drug, the bone turning over goes down a lot, but then starts to creep up again around the month mark. And it's that sort of information that led to using it every month. So, yep, you're on it every month, and you just keep coming every month, and we keep giving it to you every month. Easy. The question is, do you really need it every month? Is everyone the same? Look at you all in this room. I bet you're all a bit different. You've got different levels of cancer, different treatments you're on. Why are you all getting the drug exactly at the same? Why should everyone get it on a monthly basis? And this is just this question. Does this strategy make sense, one size fits all? Should you be this lady every month? So if you have a good example, 72-year-old lady, cancer is a hormone-driven cancer, she's actually feeling fine, she's on her little Femara or Arimidex or Tamoxifen tablet, everything's really quiet, she had a little spot picked up on a bone scan, we've put her onto a bone treatment, should she really have to come every month to get Zometa? Which does hang around for about 2 years, a single shot, you can pick it up in the system 2 years later. Is that overdoing it? Compare that to this lady, a 37-year-old lady. She's got a hormone-negative cancer, which we sort of know are a little bit more aggressive. She's already had a fracture. She's already had a few problems with her spine. She's had chemos and stuff, a more aggressive type of cancer. Yeah, you probably do want to give it to her every month because she's got a cancer that's more sort of virulent, so to speak. So you're trying to, should we treat those two ladies in exactly the same way with the bone therapy? That's the question. I mean, the logic would be no, and yet the teaching is yes. Put them on every month. So many of us have automatically, just over time, in our own brain, we separate those patients and say, look, you've been on this treatment for a long time, everything's really good, you've done a few scans, everything's very quiet, your tumour markers are good and stuff. Hey, there are some side effects of these drugs. Do you want to come a little bit less often? Maybe you go from 4 weeks to 6 weeks and then to 8 weeks. And my lady's been on for 8 years, 9 years. She has a dose every 3 months, no, 4 months now. And the prostate cancer doctors who treat, men are generally the weaker species, aren't they? Little old men. They do that very early on. They give a couple of monthly doses and then say, everything seems quiet, come back every 3 or 4 months. They've done it for a long time. Now, the problem is, and this is where it gets all a bit cynical, there's never been any incentive for the pharmaceutical industry to look for less frequent dosing. Would they? Why would they do that? You know, they'd only lose money out of it, so they're not interested in that question, really. So there's been a couple of guys who have been interested. And this was a trial called the Bismarck study, which a guy in England set up. We tried to, I tried to hook into it with him, but there was funding issues. We couldn't get the amount of money, or his organisation couldn't provide the amount of money that we would have needed to do all the tests and stuff on the trial. And it's very expensive doing bone scans and x-rays and all that, so we couldn't quite hook in. But great concept. The concept was you get patients who've got the bone secondaries. They've been on their Zometa for a year or so, so you've got plenty on board. And then you would divide them into two groups. One that just continues on that every monthly treatment, like most people. And the other ones would get their treatment depending on how active their bones were. And you can test that. It's a bit complicated. You can test it. So if their bones were really quiet, you'd get it less frequently. And if their bones were very active, you'd get it more frequently. So trying to use some sort of science, you know, mathematics, and saying, well, should you come every month, or should you come every 2 months, or can we just see you every 4 months? So a really interesting idea. Many of us are doing that sort of automatically anyway, but nice to have some proof. Now, this trial sort of finally got done in the UK only, not as many patients as he'd hoped. It just took a long time. Because there are a lot of patients who say, no, I'm on it every month, I'm happy on that. You know, and a lot of clinicians say, oh no, you're on every month, and everything seems to be going, why would I want to change that? But I've got other patients saying, I'd love to come less frequently. But then you say, well, if I come less frequency, will the cat, you know, so it's an emotional decision as well. But this is the sort of stuff that would be really good if we knew, so we knew how often to give it. You know, do we really need to give it every month, or could we give it less frequently? And I'm very relaxed about patients who want to go away for a while, you know, who are on it, to say, look, you know, can I have a break of 6 or 8 or even 12 weeks? Sure. For osteoporosis, they give these drugs once a year. They work fine. If you've got very active cancer, you're probably not going on a holiday anyway. I mean, it's the people are very low, but it's all under control. So I think a less frequent, you know, a bit of a break is not a problem. I mean, so if you're going away for 6 weeks to North Queensland and say, oh, you must have a Zometa while you're up there, you've had 2 years of it already, I'd question that call and say, do I really need it? If I'm really sick and got problems, then I'm not going to go to Queensland anyway. If I'm feeling good and I'm going, then why not have a longer break? Not a problem. So what are the safety issues? So you can probably tell me if you guys have had it. So you can get a flu-like reaction, particularly with the first treatment. And I've got a few patients who seem to get it with every treatment. That's pretty uncommon. People who get it less frequently get that problem. So I use it sometimes for osteoporosis, or we're quite interested in it as a way of preventing bone cancers. People get it once every 6 months. I've had some ladies who every time they get it every 6 months, they have this massive 2-day, you know, aches and pains and feel like crap for 2 days. But women who get it every month, it seems like the body gets a bit used to it. It's pretty uncommon to have those big reactions every time. But the very first time, it's very common. Kidney function, we talked a little bit about. If you give the drug far too quickly, originally they developed it 5-minutely, but it turned out that it's better 15-minutely. And there are some guidelines. If your kidneys are not perfect, to give a little bit of a lesser dose. Now the big one that everyone's interested in, particularly your dentist, is this thing called osteonecrosis of the jaw, which you may or may not have heard of. And if you haven't, and you're on bisphosphonate, someone probably should have told you about it. The interesting thing is now that's also Olivia Newton-John. So someone rang me about OMJ and I said, oh my God, what's happened? You got to the dentist? She goes, no, it's Olivia Newton-John. So now there's two OMJs out there. So it's not common at all, but it's important. If you go to your dentist, they freak out about it now. And some of them won't touch you, you know, without all these, you know, safeguards. But it's almost translators. Now, anyone who's got breast cancer, some dentists say, can I do any dental work? You know, they haven't got it. They're not on anything. Of course you can do something. But it is an important issue, and I'll show you. So we're not quite sure what causes it, but basically the idea is this. Your jawbone is a bone like any other. You pull a tooth out, you've got a hole in your bone, has to heal up. Mouth is full of germs. If that hole heals up slowly, you've got a chance of germs getting into that hole, getting into the bone that's there, and causing an infection. That can happen in anyone. But if your bone heals very slowly,
that hole fills up slowly, the chance of getting infection is higher. And these drugs that we use slow the bone down. They do slow healing down. They prevent you getting fractures, but if you've got a fracture, if you get a fracture on it, the bone, because it's not turning over so quickly, it takes longer for it to heal up. So if you've got a hole in your jawbone because the tooth's been yanked out, it's going to take longer to heal up, and therefore the risk of getting infection in there is a bit higher. Now, it's not a... Funny enough, I treat probably as many breast cancer patients as nearly anyone in Australia. I've yet to see it. And I've got heaps of patients. And yet other people I know who... Oh, I've seen 10 of them. So I don't know whether they have, or they're just being a bit melodramatic. Or they say a toothache is the problem, which is not. But people with bad-fitting dentures, people with terrible mouth hygiene... I mean, you do see some people sort of never go to dentists, and you open their mouth full of... So what we've learned is that if you've got a mouth looking like that, don't start the bone treatment. Go and get fixed up. And of course, there are dentists everywhere, and they're really cheap, aren't they? You can see them straight away, so that's never a problem. Or if someone, this lady the other day who needs to start it, of course, she's got some major crown work being done and root canals and stuff, you know, and you think, oh, why don't you try and get that all fixed up before we start the bone treatment? But then, of course, sometimes it's going to take 6 months to get my dental work done. So, okay, well, you know, then it gets complicated. But good mouth hygiene and checking the mouth out once in a while is pretty important. So it's rare, but if you're on these drugs for a long time, of course, the risk goes up a little bit. And that's why people are interested in maybe giving them less frequently. You know, I've got patients who've been on them for years, and you're thinking, you know, should I keep going? Should I do it less frequently? Would that be helpful? We don't know those questions. But it's about a 1% rate. Now, if you don't have bone treatments and you've got a 10, 15, 20% rate of fractures and high calcium, well, I mean, hey, I'll tell you, I'll take the 1% jaw thing rather than a 20% chance of fracturing my back because I could never walk again. It's a pretty easy option for me. But if you're doing really well, well, of course, you don't want your mouth being a problem. Most resolve, but not all resolve. And one of the, you know, obviously keeping your mouth and teeth clean. And you can go to the dentist, they'll have cleaning and fillings and all the normal stuff. Much as you hate that.
But whitening.
Yeah, no, those things. It's about exposing and getting into the gum, you know, the jaw. That's the problem. So normal dental stuff, you know, when they pick away and they, you know, horrible. I went the other day, I hate them.
Does the measure around the ninja make the bone break down around the teeth?
But
if you've got good teeth, yeah. Does it actually, I mean, as we age, our bone recedes, but does the measure then also make it destroy it a little bit?
Not directly, but one of the issues with the bone is the bone that you make, because you're constantly making bone, you know, there's constantly a bit of turnover, old bone being eaten away, new bone being made. Is that bone as good when you're on Zometa or those drugs as it would have been in normal thing? And there's some question mark, is the bone, ironically, although it's stronger, is it in fact a bit more brittle? You know, so some, I mean, it happened at home the other day, a strong thing was dropped and it shattered. Because it was brittle but very strong. You know, you couldn't bend it either, but if you dropped it. So some of those strong things can be brittle if it's made in a slightly strange way. So there are some issues with these drugs. In the osteoporosis world, there's a lot of discussion about them. They certainly decrease fracture rates, but if you're on them for years, could the bone that you end up with be a little bit funny? Now, in the advanced cancer setting, to be honest, your number one goal has got to be to stay out of hospital and not get fractures from your cancer. And, I mean, to me, these are important things to try and work out, but they don't overlay the fact that hardly any of you have been in hospital with a bad bone. Some have, but, you know, well, 20, 30 years ago, probably all of you would have been. And not just once, but multiple times. So, but these are big issues if we start using these drugs to prevent cancer, because then, you know, women who may not even need them, who may be cured just by the surgery, might be going on these things, and then you're starting to think, well, we've got to make sure that it's a balance, you know, that we're not causing too many other problems with them. You know, so there's someone's had a tooth pulled out and sort of a problem there, and there's a plaque, sort of a white, the gum is sort of being affected. Stuff. So, you know, so it's really exposed bone, usually with some sort of dental surgery or some, you know, bad dentures or some other problem. You know, it's not healing very quickly.
it's not caused because there's actual cancer in the jaw, not that I've ever actually seen that. But everyone has a different classification. I mean, it's a complicated area and there's millions of committees being set up to try and define it. But of course, some people, you know, who say, oh, my tooth's a bit sore, saying, oh my God, you've got osteonecrosis, which is not true. How do you do it? Before you start, you know, make sure that you have at least a look in the mouth. So unfortunately, I've had to look into a lot of people's mouths recently. You know, avoid, I mean, if you don't need that root canal done, don't do it. You know, don't fat in the pocket of your dentist. But if it needs to be done, it needs to be done. I mean, I have a lady who's been on a bisphosphonate for 4 or 5 years, and she just had to have something done. And the nice thing, the dentist rang and said, look, I'm going to do it, not a problem, but I just have to tell her there's about a 15% chance she may get an infection because she's been on it for a long time, she's got terrible teeth. But you've got to do it because it's falling apart, it's broken, it's causing you daily problems. And she said, well, you've just got to do it. You know, that's I've got no way around it.
Is there also just a time span you can be off, like with some cement, for example, and then you get the dental work?
Probably some cement, it never goes away. That's the downside. So we instinctively say, oh, don't have any for a dose or two, but the reality is probably makes zero difference because cemeta gets into the bones and sits there. It just sits there. So they did an experiment once where they gave normal volunteers one dose and then did little bone biopsies. About 2 years later, they could still see the effect of the cemeta in that bone. One single dose. So that's why that question is, do you need it every month, keeps coming up. If it's so powerful, it hangs around so long. And the frustrating thing is, after all the years, we don't have the answer to that, how regular to have it. We don't, I mean, so stopping one dose probably makes no difference, but I will do it anyway because it's not going to be a, if your cancer, missing a dose or two makes no difference probably either. So we instinctively go, stop, you know, hopefully it may have an effect. Might be a bit different with the other drug I'm about to come to if I'm going to keep going. Look, if you do get osteonecrosis, then the first question is, do you have to keep going on the bone treatment? But then that becomes a benefit, you know, risk benefit. If you've got 28 bone spots and you've already had a fracture somewhere and you've got pain, well, yeah, I'd keep going on it. If you've got this tiny little spot and you've been on it because just in case, you might say, well, maybe I'll stop it for a while and focus more on my jaw. But yeah, everyone's going to have a unique circumstance for that. So just to finish off, what are some controversies on Zometa? So this whole question of, you know, should we be checking your bones and how active they are as a way of judging how often to give the treatment, that question, don't have an answer for that. That continues to be a question that's been around. What's the ideal frequency and duration? Sorry?
How do you check that?
With a urine test. Yeah. Now it is available, a little bit complicated test, it is available. And I remember reading an article once, a group in West Australia looked at the women who'd had that test in their hospital. They were doing it for osteoporosis. And then looked at the charts to see whether the doctor who ordered it actually ever used the test to do anything. And they almost never did. So it was like, they were having it, but no one was even using the result to change their treatment. So why were they bothering to do it if not going to use the test? So it's this thing that's been sitting out there in the periphery. It's been talked about for years. Should we be, you know, it's a bit like doing tumour markers. You know, do you do tumour markers to follow your treatment? Should you be doing bone markers to follow your bone treatment to see do you need to up it or down it or increase it or decrease it? And it just quite hasn't broken through. I'm not quite sure why. It's not an easy test to do. You know, it's got to be second urine and got to be specially handled because the sunlight affects it and stuff. So it's not just like writing up for a quick blood test. But yeah, so we tended, because most people do pretty well on the bone treatments and stuff, we've just tended to trottle, you know, sort of muddle along with what we've been doing. But it is a question that you know, it'd be nice to have an answer. As I said, the problem is that every time they've tried to do a big study with it, either it doesn't seem to recruit or they can't get the finances for it. And in fact, it's potentially becoming superseded because of the new drugs that are coming through. But then that feeds into that question, how often should I have it? How long should I have it? Should I have it forever? Or can I have breaks from it? Can I stretch it out to 6 or 8 weekly or 3 monthly? And I do have patients on it, and I think most of my patients, if they've been going for a while, will probably start saying, do I have to come this frequently for the intravenous treatment? And what happens if you're on it? Sorry?
It sounds like then that you should start Zometa. It, should you start the treatment upon diagnosis of a bone problem immediately? And should, that's one part of the question. The other one is, should it be taken concurrently with radiation therapy, or is there any reason not to do that?
So, long-term treatment, the short-term timing doesn't matter so much. That's how generally the thing. Yeah, so it's not like, oh my God, you know, it's not like leukemia. If you don't start chemo, you know, at midnight, you know, they may not be there the next morning. It's not like that at all. You know, you've got time to think about it, and sometimes I don't start until, you know, the chemotherapy's finished or later on during the chemo, because there's a lot of things going on, you know. So, you know, if you've had surgery and you're having radiation, you've got some chemo, I mean, the bone thing can come in a little bit later, and I'll add it in when I think we're ready. I don't think it makes any difference whether you started at day one or a month or two later. That's not an issue. It does affect healing a bit. So if someone's had surgery or, you know, to bone, I'd rather let, and radiation to bone, there's going to be a lot of natural healing going on. Give that a chance to do its thing and then add it in, because it will dampen natural healing. If you fracture your wrist and you're on Zometa, it'll heal, it'll take longer. And they've done experiments with rats where they break a rat's thigh bone and they take... I think she was a rat out of my house. And they look at it heal, and then they get a rat, the same type of rat, and they feed it some, or give it some meta, break the bone and watch it heal. And it heals, but it takes longer in a slightly more haphazard way. Because healing requires those little munches just as much as it requires the bricklayers. And if you've switched off the munches with the Zometa, well, not completely, but they get to it in the end, but it's just not as quite as good. And I suppose I like the building analogy. If you need, you know, if you're rebuilding your back shed, and you've got a guy who's breaking down the old shed and a guy building the new one as he's doing it, if the guy who's breaking it down just doesn't turn up for a week, well, the guy who's building it is a bit stuck. You know, do a few things, but if he just keeps doing it, well, you're going to get a funny sort of thing because the old one hasn't been broken down properly. So the concept is, and you want both of them in there working together. If one's not working quite at the same speed, they'll eventually get there, but it'll take a bit longer, and it may need a bit more work to get it into a nice shape. So it's a funny thing that this fossil, fantastic to try and prevent you from having a fracture, but if you have one while you're on it, the healing process takes longer. So the issue of, actually, I've had two ladies recently who've been going on Zometa for quite a long time. Two, it's funny, in a week came in with high calcium levels, very high calcium levels, you know, like really sick levels, suggesting that the bone treatment wasn't doing its job anymore. So I talked about bones are the warehouse of calcium, and basically the floodgates had opened, they was all pouring out because the cancer was sort of getting active again, opening up the door, and the Zometa wasn't doing its job and controlling it. So until recently, what do? That's all you really got is the Zometa. You've got older ones, which are not as powerful. The first thing you do is you have to change their cancer treatment, chemos and stuff. But it was a question, do you just then keep going on the Zometa and change the chemos or the hormones? That's sort of what we did. But now we've got a new drug. So I shifted both of them onto the Xgeva, as well as making some other adjustments. So now suddenly we've got two drugs that we can think about. So now the logic to me is, if I've got someone on Zometa, they're doing fine, I'll leave them on it. But if I don't like what it's doing or it's a problem, I've now got another drug that works slightly differently that I might be able to shift them to. And that's this last bit of my talk. So this is a new target. This is complicated, but I'll try and simplify. So here's our bone again, and here's our little friendly Pac-Man called the osteoclast, munching away the bones. So the bisphosphonate works down here by poisoning that a little bit by sitting there. But what some, you know, the lab, the laboratory people worked out is that this is our bricklayer, funnily enough. Our bricklayer speaks to our little Pac-Man through this thing here. There's a little message that goes out that stimulates these guys to get more and more. And what they've worked out is cancers, various other things, produce things that actually stimulate our little bricklayer to then stimulate the Pac-Man to eat more. So they worked out there's a pathway there. So this drug, denosumab, is designed to stop these little guys that are coming from here to attach to these guys who eat your bones.
So the idea is a bit the same as what a meta does in a very different way, what we call a more targeted way. So the meta is just like lying a wet blanket over the bone, sort of poisoning a few things, and it works very well. This is trying to be a bit cleverer and saying, well, now we understand really, you know, we've got the telephone line that goes from there to there, let's cut that telephone line and stop them talking to each other, which stops them from growing and being active, which in turn stops them from eating the bone. So the same idea, stopping the bone munching, but doing it in a more specific sort of way. So we always like things that are more particular because we hope they're going to be more effective. You know, so you can get a shotgun and shoot rather than, you know, picking your target and just, you know, doing one bullet. We'd rather do the one because the shotgun effect has more side effects, more we think. So this was a study that's now out, and it's been out for a while. We were very heavily involved with it here in Melbourne. So this was a study. Adults with advanced breast cancer, they've got it in their bones, they haven't yet started a bone treatment. So, and they were randomised into, they were divided into those who got the standard Zometa, you know, just like many of you, or the new drug. And there was a placebo in it. So patients were fantastic. They consented to get an infusion and a little injection under the skin. Everyone got both of those things. In one group, what they got in there was a fake, and in the other group it was real, and in one group got a fake injection on the skin, the other group got a real one. That was the only way you can do it to really work out what they're doing. You've got to have that. Otherwise, if you know what you're on, that changes things. You know, patients and doctors can be very easily coached. Oh yeah, I feel much better. It's great because they're on the new thing. Yeah, it's fantastic. This way you don't know what you're on. And calcium and vitamin D. So 1,000 women in each arm, average age in the 50s, all were pretty fit and well, they had to be. Many were hormone positive, 70%, as you'd expect. Bones, hormone positive cancer go together. The average time from when their first bone spot was picked up to when they started the study was about 2 months. So there's your question, do you have to start straight away? The average time was a couple of months. About a third of the patients had previously already had a problem with their bones. Well, that's how you find it in a lot of patients. You know, a lot of patients turn up with a pain or a fracture, and so you've, oh my God, I've got bone set injuries. So about a third, interesting, two-thirds hadn't. They were picked up just by a scan or a test or something. And about half the patients had spots in their livers and lungs as well. You know, so half were just bone and half had both. And this is the main result. So look, this is complicated, but I'm a simple guy. If the blue line's above the orange line, that's got to be a good thing. And if you can fit your finger between them, that's usually a very good thing. So, yeah, can, so that's good. If they're very close together, then it's no different. What does this mean? What does this mean is you had 100 patients who walked in the door who, at that moment in time, did not have a problem with their bones per se. They had cancer in their bones, but it had been, they were okay. And then you follow them month by month by month to see who has a problem in their bones, a fracture, need radiation, need surgery, you know, come in with a bone problem that needs intervention, this skeletal related event we talk about. So if you get the Zometa, and that's 100% with no problem, so as you follow the time, you go to the 50%, so at about 26, 27 months, so over 2 years, in the woman on Zometa, half of those women have had a bone problem. So about 100 women getting Zometa, by about 2 years, about half of them have had a bone problem, half haven't. And that in itself is actually a really good result compared to the old days. But the new treatment, you can see the blue line, at that 26 months, it hasn't got to the half yet. You know, it's about 60%. So there's, you know, we haven't even got to the half point yet. So what's that saying is if you're on the new drug versus the old drug, both are very good, but the new drug, the denosumab, seems to be delaying the bone problems a bit more. And the statistics are all quite strong. Now remember, these are patients who had not ever had treatment before. This is not patients who had already been on Zometa and switched, which is probably the big question people are going to ask, should I switch? Now the company that makes the drug, Amgen, have been asking, why don't you switch? And I say, well, it's very simple. There's been no trial for switching. Now this is different. This is a new patient walking in the door, never been on any treatment for their bones. The XG looks a bit better than the Zometa. So to me, if I've got a brand new patient, sure, we can talk about intravenous versus the subcutaneous injection, and the subcutaneous looks like it's a little bit better, and you know, there's a convenience if you don't like coming to hospitals. The GP can do it, the patients can do it themselves even if they want to learn how to do it. So it has doesn't cause any kidney problems at all, so if you've got kidney issues, etc. So there are some advantages. Some patients don't like that, it does cost you money, you have to take a script. Some patients like to come to the hospital and get their treatment if they're having chemo anyway, or Herceptin. I say, I just have it at the same time as the Herceptin, you know. And it's not a matter of life or death, it's a matter of bone issue. So some of my colleagues are not even starting new patients on it, because they're just used to what they've always done. And doctors are very conservative usually, and inertia is a strong thing. So even if a new thing comes along that looks a little bit better, if they've been for 10 years using Zometa and it's been working really well, and you know, it takes a while for that sort of to percolate through. But it is what it is.
Can I just say that's me? I haven't had anything yet. And I actually was telling my oncologist about your talk from last year. Actually, he probably was your teacher. This denosumab is better. And he's going, because I have to go to have a septic too. So he's going, yeah, but the trial, you know, they pretty well came out like this. And so on Tuesday, that's exactly what I was saying to my employer. So
look, it gets complicated, and I don't want to be negative at any individuals, but. I had a think tank recently, there's four of us in the room talking about denosumab. I was clearly at one end. I said, all my new patients, that's going to be my standard unless there's a reason not to do it. But the other two, breast, there's a prostate cancer from two other breast cancer ladies, one who'd never used it and one who'd used it once. And clearly, I mean, they accepted this information. They perhaps don't know it as well as I do because I was involved in it. But they just weren't ready to change yet. And the people running the think tank were getting frustrated. Why not? You know, you've got a new treatment that's better, and it really boils down to what I've always done, and I'm most comfortable with it, and the mechanisms are all set up, the nurses are ready, I can just sign it and off you go. This is a little bit more complicated because you've got to, you know, are you going to give it in the chemotherapy unit, the injection, or are you going to go to your GP? Have you got a GP? Has he got a nurse? Is he going to charge you? You know, is it going to cost you a bit more money? There's money complications, and this is where it gets all a bit complicated. Even though chemotherapy units in private can charge health funds for intravenous treatments. They technically can't charge it for subcutaneous treatments. So I'm not being cynical, it's a real problem. I brought it up to Amgen. I said, you've got to think about this, because a lot of doctors out there in the private setting who, you know, there's a whole system that's been set up to treat people and get them in, and, you know, that's how the business works. And then you say, oh, those 30 people a month that are coming in don't need to come, potentially may not need to come in the future. They can go to their GP and get the injection. That's a loss of turnover for that unit. And although that shouldn't matter, of course it matters, you know, private is a business, and the government hasn't got a mechanism for funding subcutaneous treatment or oral treatment by that matter. So if you go to the States, they almost never give treatments that aren't funded, because you know, America is completely about business. Every treatment is designed to generate money. That's not as big an issue here, but it still is an issue. But in the public hospital setting, you know, they may want to shift people out because they're always so busy. So they might be encouraging you, don't come here, you go to your GP. But what if the GP doesn't want to give you the injection? What if he wants to charge you $50 to come and get the injection? You're saying, I can get it for my treatment for free with the nurses, or I've got to go to my GP who wants to, you know. So it's a little more complicated. We're not used to subcutaneous injections yet. I mean, you know, that's not a mechanism, but it's coming. And Herceptin's going to come out in subcutaneous in the not distant future as well. So suddenly there's going to be another drug that patients may want to give it to themselves. They're developing this sort of funny, slightly obscene looking machine that will do an injection for you.
Well, you give yourself your injection and then you
last it. Some patients love that, others look at you and say, I'm not touching myself with a needle. So it's a bit more complicated. And complications mean time and discussion and explanation. So it's another thing. People don't realise, I'm always running late. If people see a thing that's going to take an extra half an hour to explain and discuss, they may stick to what they've always done, which they can say, go to the chemo nurses, they'll give you the drug. So even though there's that difference, people can justify in their own head why they're not going to use it.
that is complicated. Sorry, just the caveat.
Can I ask a question about the results? You said that 70% of people who were in the trial were hormone receptive. Did you see any difference in the results between people who weren't hormone receptive and those
question that
around the outcomes?
They haven't said that yet, but I can predict that the overall result will be much better in the hormone positive. So all things, hormone negative cancers tend to be more aggressive. So I think there'll still be the split, but that curve will be a bit steeper. They're more likely to have problems earlier because hormone negative cancers are a little bit harder to control because you haven't got the hormone treatments. Yeah, but I haven't seen the actual division presented. Sorry.
Yeah, this was a study for people who had not yet had an SRE, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, you could have. A third had already had an SRE.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, knowing you could have gone to that study even though you've probably got it. Yeah, because you haven't had treatment for it. I mean, you could have had surgery or whatever, but you couldn't have had the Zometa yet.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to say, I've switched from the old treatment to the new, and it's so simple. And I only got to get it back every 2 months.
Yeah.
But I do get it every 4 weeks. And there's no pain, nothing. It's just.
Yeah, so that's, you can do an advertisement for Andy and I'd love you.
They'll be in it for a whole day.
Does it actually aggravate symptoms at all initially?
So Meta does. So Meta can be for a couple of days afterwards.
It discouraged me from using it now, so I'm just generating therapy to wait until that settles down before we go to it.
I think settling down after a bit of radiation is never a problem anyway. I mean, we're waiting a week or two for your symptoms. I never start chemotherapy straight after a prolonged dose of radiation. Why not have a week or two just to let it settle and then get going? Unless it's, say, critical, but that's not that common.
Just questions. I started on, I've only had one dose, 2 weeks ago, but not a we started out with normal calcium levels. I still should be taking a calcium because I've been on Zometa and Rondinac for a few years now and had no calcium problems.
So it's unlikely you will. It's small. You should definitely be on vitamin D.
Vitamin D.
Yeah. Now, if you've had no trouble and your calcium levels have been fine, I mean, I don't think you need to necessarily change what you've been doing.
Okay.
The incidence of the calcium problem is a little bit higher with denosumab because I think it's a bit more potent, it's a bit more powerful drug, it's a bit more specific. But initially it's also more short-lived. It doesn't hang around as long as the Zometa. So it holds, at least to us, the option, if you stop it in someone who has a problem, maybe there's a quicker recovery of the normal bone. We don't know that for sure, but that's sort of a hope. I'll get to that in a minute. So this is the other result. Because our bone things happen in sometimes in pairs or triplets, what they looked at, not just the time to have the first bone problem, but let's also look at over the whole study, every patient, how many bone problems they had, if they had one or two or three, let's add them all up, work out which is better. And so again, the denosumab overall, the number of events that were happening, not just the first event, but also including the second and third events, again, there was a split. A difference between the two groups. I mean, you see the raw numbers there. There were 608 events for Zometa and 470 events, and they had the same number of patients. So 130 less events happening. Remember, this was blinded. We didn't know what they were on. So people, you know, we didn't. That's why you have to do it. Otherwise, you can cheat and say, "Oh, you got a bit of pain in your rib. Ah, that's an event. Ah, you know." But because you didn't know what they were on, you're not encouraged to cheat. Time to experiencing moderate or severe pain. So these were patients who didn't have much pain when they started. Now, there were plenty of patients who did have pain when they started, but if you had 100 patients who didn't have pain, this is the time to developing pain, because of course pain does develop sometimes. And here, again, you can see there is a split favouring the denosumab. I mean, you still get pain developing, unfortunately, in, this is not all patients, but it takes longer to happen. So the average number of days till that person, these people who did get severe pain, it took 90 days versus 60 days, so 3 months versus 2 months. I mean, that's not, we're not talking, rocket science, it's unbelievable, but it's a little extra step. So that's why some people go say, it's all a little bit here and there. I mean, it's not like, we're saving the world. I'm going to keep doing some matters easy, I've done it for years. While others say, it's a step forward. Why wouldn't you at least think about it? But the important thing is, and I'm completely, you know, upfront, that's progression of the cancer. There's no finger can fit between them. It's the same, because cancer progression and cancer survival relates to good cancer treatment, treating the cancer with your hormones, your Herceptins, your chemos. The bone stuff is about preventing fractures and things, which affects quality of life primarily. Occasionally it can actually lead to people really going bad. If you get a spinal cord compression, you can't walk, it's terrible. But that's pretty rare these days. So not surprising to me, because we look after our patients much better. You know, these drugs are mainly about quality of life and need for radiation and pain issues. They're not sort of about you know, survival. That's about your cancer treatments per se. So there's no difference there. Side effects. Serious side effects. I mean, remember, a lot of these patients got chemotherapy as well. They include everything. So nearly every patient had some side effect because they're all on other treatment as well. So here's some things. So first, that reaction you get to Zometa. So 27% of people had some sort of reaction, 10% in the denosumab arm. So it's interesting, people react no matter what you give them, but 10% versus about 30%, and that's what I would expect. Kidney side effects. Overall, about 8.5% got kidney problems of some sort, 5% there, which is tells you some people get kidney problems for other reasons. Osteonecrosis of the jaw, or Olivia Newton-John. Now, you can see the number actually is against the denosumab. Now, if you crunch in the statistics, it's actually about the same, but the raw number is a little bit more. And for some reason, I remember when we started these trials, for some reason we thought it might be less, but in retrospect, of course, if anything, it's going to be more, because it's a more targeted treatment, it's more powerful. So there is a little bit more osteonecrosis, at least not statistically, but it's not less. And the thing that I haven't got here is the other side effect that primarily relates to denosumab is this low calcium level. There's more low calcium, so again, that's a bit more powerful. So it's that trade-off. You know, we've got other drugs like that. Sometimes when you see a new patient, there's a trade-off. Do I give them the drug that I think is going to work the best, but also it's got more side effects? Or am I going to give a drug that's pretty good, but a little bit less effective, but it also has a lot less, you know, sometimes you've got to make that balance, you know, between when you see a patient to decide which path you're going to go down. But this is the way, I think this is a nice graph. So if you have a patient with bone secondary who gets no treatment, 64% of them will have a bone problem in the first 2 years. If you give pamidronate, which is the old Iridia, only 43% got a problem in 2 years. If you give them Zometa, only 34% will get a problem in 2 years. And now if you give denosumab, statistically, 27% will get a problem in 2 years. So it just keeps getting better. Now, the smallest difference is here, yeah? Because the treatments are getting better. So to have no treatment, boy, what a huge jump that was, now 20% improvement. That was the older one. We went to Zometa, we got a 9% extra benefit, and here we get a 7% extra benefit. For some people, wow, fantastic. For others, I say, okay, it's interesting, but is it enough to convince me to change? That goes to people's own conservatism or their own practice or whatever. So I can't yell at someone for not putting a new patient on it, but the question is what's the reason you don't want to do it? And there may be a reason. As I said, there's lots of, it's different. It is injection here versus here. It is at home or GP versus hospital. There are some funding sort of complications. You do have to pick up the script yourself and pay your script cost. You don't have to with Zometa, it's covered by the government. So, you know, if you're a $35 a script person, there's $35 a month, every month. That doesn't sound like a lot to some, it's a lot for others. I've already had one patient, a friend of mine, who said a patient rang him and said, I used to be on Zometa, it didn't cost me a cent, I got a free cup of tea. Now I'm off to the biscuit, now I've got to go to the chemist and I've got to pay $35 for script and the GP, I can't get in, and it's all too complicated, I want to come back, you know, give me the thing. So it sounds funny, but for some people that's an issue. And just last thing, this is all about upfront treatment, okay? I think the switching treatment is more complicated. There has not been a trial for that yet. So if someone came to me and said, I'm on Zometa and I'm sick of it, can I switch to the Xgeva? I'll say, yeah, sure. If I don't have proof that it's going to be better than just staying on the Zometa, the proof I've got is that if you start head-to-head in a horse race, the Xgeva wins, just wins, is a bit ahead of it. But if you're already halfway through the race, should you jump, you know, horses, I don't know that yet.
but I don't have a problem with it. I don't think it's going to be worse. So if you're sick of needles, or your veins are shot, or you've lost your health insurance, and so you have to pay to go to the free mate, all those things. Well, hey, yeah, let's switch you over. I'm comfortable with it. But if you're happy on the Zometa and you've been cruising along and you like the nurses and you've got a good relationship and you see the oncologist the same day, so you like popping in and you get your script for OxyContin filled and it sort of works for you, fine. That's what I loved at just yesterday. She's happy. The nurses actually said, do you want to switch her? I said, do you want to switch her? No, I'm quite happy just keeping things as is. That's fine. I'm comfortable with that. So this has been the standard of care, and many of you are on it. We still have this issue, is should we be being a bit smarter about how we use these drugs and measuring bone turnover? Still lots of questions about how best to use Zometa. It's a bizarre, it's been around now for 10 or 15 years. And I think it reflects sometimes in our world is that you set a new benchmark, there's still some questions that need to be resolved, but then we're moving on to the next one. And the time and effort is no longer put into the old one because everyone's moving on to the new thing. That's a very American style, with all due respect. Once a new medication has been started, everyone's looking for the next big thing, and that's old hat already. Sometimes we don't go back and say, let's go to the old hat thing and try and understand it better. Let's spend a bit of time and money on working out how best to use it. Sometimes the whole world is moving on to the next thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing, and some of the good things that we've already got, we don't really ever fully understand, and they sort of get superseded. So there's still questions about how often and all those things that, we may never answer. And yeah, denosumab, and then there are others that are going to come along. They're certainly promising, certainly nice now to have a choice, and certainly nice when my two ladies broke through the Zometa with their high calcium. I had another drug that I felt comfortable was going to be as good, if not perhaps a little bit better, and I could quite happily switch them over on that and feel that we're doing some good work there. And this is my last slide. Yeah, I can drop things as well when I see this slide. Perfect timing. So this is that complicated vicious cycle or feeding. So here's the cancer cell, here's it producing all these funny numbered things, going in, feeding some of, this is the bone here, these are the little bone makers here that are then stimulated to feed into the bone breakers and make them grow, and then they eat the bone and all these things get released and they go back to feed the cancer cell and you go round and around. And so the better you understand all these things, then people start developing drugs that can interfere with that. So if you go to a multiple myeloma meeting, they've got a whole bunch of drugs that attack this thing called DKK1, which is not really a great interest in breast cancer, it's not a big issue, but they're huge into that. We're into this now, that's the denosumab attacking this sort of thing. The bisphosphonates, you can see, they work down here to poison these guys off. And there's other drugs being developed at all different levels of this for different reasons, not just for cancer, for osteoporosis and stuff like that. So it's a really interesting area, lots of work happening there. But for the woman on the street, we've got the Zometa, we've got the Bondronat, we've got the intravenous tablet, and we've now also got the Xgeva available.
I was just going to ask a question about prevention, and maybe it's another one.
I think if I had a lady like that, had osteoporosis, and particularly from hormone therapy that can cause osteoporosis.
No, but
you can argue, what osteoporosis, and I need a bone strengthener, and the bone strengthener may have a beneficial effect against the cancer, seen or unseen. Why not go on it? I mean, the reason you would go on it is it's an extra treatment and the
different dosages as a result of it being osteoporosis.
Yeah, so the osteoporosis dose is either 6 or 12 monthly, while the treatment dose is every month. But in the early breast cancer world, where we're interested in preventing bone seconds, we've got some nice trials that look sort of useful in 6 monthly dosing. So a couple of patients have heard about that and said, I want to buy a 6 monthly dose of Zometa, because I think it could help maybe my breast cancer world, and if it helps me with my slightly thin bones at the same time.
That was my question with funding. My understanding of PBS is
there is no
bit. It's not a very expensive treatment per se. It's about $400, which if you do it once a year, yeah. And XGEVA is not that much more. The problem is getting it given to you. So that's where XGEVA is potentially a really useful thing, because you can give it to yourself. Your GP can give it. The problem with intravenous treatments is you can't walk into the Royal Melbourne and say, I bought this drug, can you give it to me? They'll say, well, sorry, it's against the rules. But I bought that. You're not allowed to give drugs that you buy yourself. Well, can you give it? No, because it's not got the government scheme. It's a bad luck. You go to a private place, they'll charge you $1,000 to send a check. So suddenly it becomes $1,500 to have that treatment. So in fact, it's a very unfair system. But that's the public system won't let you buy drugs of your own, because that's not a fair thing, because if you're rich and you're not, you can have different treatments, not allowed. So we'll have no treatments instead. And in the private system, sure, but you can pay the money. So the beauty about, and I actually, before I came here today, we were just talking about that. A lady exactly a bit like you, who's got a bit of osteoporosis, who doesn't qualify by a million years for any government stuff. I said, well, what we could think about her buying denosumab on a private script. Go to GP, get it. And denosumab is available, certainly in the States now, it's already being used quite widely for osteoporosis. It's a slightly different dose and different frequency. And it's been tested quite extensively in early cancer to see if it will prevent bone secondaries. So I'll give you a whole talk on that. I'm a believer in it, but unfortunately most of the trials that have been done so far, the message is a bit mixed. As the Americans would say, we've hit a home run here. So we don't know that for sure, and there's some negative results, there's some positive results, so it remains a slightly complex area. But it's frustratingly close, and people like me have done, you know, worked in this for a long time would love to have that final piece of the puzzle that says, if you've got a lady with this sort of breast cancer and you give her a bone drug, the chance of her getting a bone secondary will drop by 15, 20 or 30%. That's what we're hoping for. We haven't quite got that. And so it's not standard treatment. I better wrap up in a minute. Any other last questions? Sorry, I've gone too long.
It's not really a question, you just answered why I'm being treated as a private patient in the public system and I've been switched to Faslodex,
yep.
The hormone.
Yep.
And I wondered why they couldn't give it, but that doesn't explain.
Well, Faslodex is not on the PBS either,
that's
because nothing doesn't work, it works great, but the Australian government said, yeah, you can apply for the PBS to AstraZeneca, but you have to drop the price.
Mm.
And AstraZeneca said, bugger off, we're not dropping the price. They said, well, we're not going to approve the drug. So it's purely about money. So, and it's very political, because if they drop the price in Australia, well then Canada will say, well, why don't you drop the price for us? So they don't want to do that. So they have this scheme, though, where you have to pay the first 3 months yourself, and then AstraZeneca will pay the rest as while you stay on it. But, yeah, again, it's an issue about money, not about effectiveness.
No, but I was wondering why the chemo medicines couldn't give it.
I just wanted to ask about renal function with the denosumab.
Renal function?
Yeah, because I have gone on to that because of my impairment. But it seems like there's still.
Now we think that's just the baseline rate of people having some kidney problems anyway, from all their other, all their other. Like if you were under the trial, I'd say, well, you've had a renal problem. So it's like, we don't think it causes renal problems because it doesn't work in the kidneys at all.
So it won't worsen a pre-existing problem.
No, and it's seen as a real big breakthrough for myeloma and prostate cancer because it doesn't have the kidney issue. Now maybe in the next 5 years it's used more. Other issues may come up. I mean, this calcium thing has suddenly jumped up because, once you get a drug out into the market, suddenly it gets used like that, and it gets used in sicker people too. And our trials are incredibly well controlled. They're perfect patients, well behaved, turn up on time, do everything right. In the real world, people are different. And you treat sicker people, and they start using it in Eastern Europe or in India or whatever, you'll get all sorts of people with, smoke for 30, you get a whole range of little problems start to crop up that weren't seen in the trials because you've got a very homogeneous, healthy, well-looked-after group. So you've always got to watch this space. And they're quite strict on that we report side effects in so they can get some information on things that might be cropping up that they didn't expect. But I think the kidney thing should be okay. I mean, that's what I would do. If you were my patient who had a bit of a kidney problem and was on Zometa, that would be a really good reason to think about switching. Okay, I've got to wrap that up.
Fantastic. fantastic. Thank you so much, Richard. It's wonderful to have somebody come and explain a really complex topic in a way that is very understandable. So thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan Podcasts or browse existing podcasts by visiting www.brecan.org.au.